Hello and welcome to the Android Central podcast. My name is Daniel Bader. This week on the show, we go over the iPhone 12 and 12 Pro review from somebody who has actually reviewed both of them. We talked to Raymond Wong of Input Magazine, and we will get to what he thinks about those phones and more in just a second. Later in the show, we will go over the Pixel 5 versus the Pixel 4a 5G. Which one is right for you? That's a question that we've been getting quite a lot of this week. We'll go into the new Amazon Echoes, which we reviewed this week as well. We'll go over the OnePlus 8T, which Raymond has also reviewed. And finally, we will go through some crazy phones that were released in 2020. We'll just round up all the cool, weird stuff that was released, and Raymond's going to help us out on that. So, Raymond Wong, senior reviews editor for Input, how are you, man? Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
And also joining us, Hayato Huseman. He's our own tech reviewer extraordinaire. What's going on, man? How are you?
Hey, I'm doing all right. And I'm going to put that's my new title on my Twitter bio.
Extraordinaire.
Yeah.
you got to spell it right, though, because I never spell it right first try.
Oh, come on. I know how to spell extraordinaire.
Do you? I don't. That's,
what about
it's hard.
Guru?
Guru. Sure.
Tech guru.
I also don't, I can never spell the word embarrassed right on first try. Like, I always get the R and the S confused.
I'm learning lately that I can't really seem to type amenities properly on the first try. I always miss an M.
Amenities. But there is only one M.
Oh, yeah. See, that's, here's the problem.
See, now I'm like looking at my wall trying to spell things in my mind. Doesn't really work out that well most of the time. That's why we rely on Grammarly. This is not a plug for Grammarly, but
I was just going to ask that. Like, are we? Are you guys sponsored by Grammarly?
Yeah, we're not sponsored by Grammarly, but we should be, because if Grammarly, we use you. If you want to pay for some of our sponsorships, you'd be more than happy. All right, let's dig into some of this news review stuff. We've got a lot to go through this week. Raymond, you're formerly of Mashable. You came over from Mashable to Input when it launched. How long ago now?
So Input launched on December 16, 2019. So we're not quite a year old, almost. Kind of like the worst time to launch, you know, end of the year, there's not a lot happening. Then CS happened, and then, you know, 2020 went to crap.
Wow, I didn't realize it was so young. I honestly thought, because I think Josh was teasing it long before it actually launched.
So yeah, Josh, I believe announced Input way back in January 2019. And then the ball didn't really get rolling until the summer of 2019. And then, you know, he hired me in September 2019. So I've been here just a little over a year. We were working in the background, and then we formally launched on December 16th, 2019.
So you're there just under a year. It's been like 10, 11 months. How do you feel it's going so far? I mean, it's so hard launching a new tech pub in general, especially in this kind of economic climate. A lot of competition, but then again, like, Josh has been around the block, so he knows what's up.
I mean, I think it's extremely exciting. I wouldn't be here if I didn't believe in what we're trying to make. I think me and Josh are aligned in the fact that the web has gotten kind of boring. And if you look at our website, inputmag.com, you'll see that we go heavy on a certain aesthetic. We have certain types of content, like data cards. We call them data cards, where we really feature a big number or a important number. We have different formats. It's not just, you know, a standard blog post. You know, most sites are WordPress or whatnot, and we wanted to design and make something from the ground up that feels more modern, that's faster, and just aesthetically looks cooler. And I think you'll see that. It's, you know, there are people on two extremes. They either love our website or they kind of really can't stand it. but I think that's what makes Input different. It makes us stand out. And, you know, building a website is always hard. You know, I've built many websites over the years. I've helped Mashable grow into the behemoth that it is now. And really, we want to push storytelling forward. We want to make tools and make formats that we think works better for a product or a story that we want to tell. Whereas before, or most other sites, you know, no offense to the other sites, but like, you know, we're not working with their original tool set. You know, we're building new tool sets for what our needs are. So really, we're just, you know, having a lot of fun. 2020 has been challenging for sure, you know, for everybody, not just, you know, tech websites. And yeah, you're right. There are a lot of websites in this space compared to 10 years ago. You know, Josh came from Engadget, then he built The Verge, and now we're here at Input. So, you know, we're still working. We're working hard. Things are growing every day, which is fantastic. And, you know, 2020 was supposed to be the year for a lot of things, but, you know, we're hoping 2021 will be even better.
Well, you know, one of the things I really like about Input is that, I mean, like you said, it's got that design that can be sort of divisive, but it's such a dynamic design that I think really highlights the important things a lot better than a lot of other sites out there, for sure.
Yeah, there's just like, I mean, everyone's business model is different, right? Everyone's editorial strategy is different as well. But I think that we live in a very fast-paced Twitter, you know, feed kind of world, Instagram as well. And we want to kind of merge the best parts of these little platforms and with the web. And, you know, I'm not saying right now that, you know, we've got the perfect formula, but it isn't experimental. We're trying new things. And I think, you know, we're small enough that we can do that. And I love the building process. So, you know, again, it's super exciting. And I hope people check out our website because, you know, it's more than just reading stories on a newsfeed, you know?
Yeah. Well, thanks a lot, man. They just made us look like crap.
No, you guys are have
no,
been around
I'm
like forever and, you know, are irreplaceable.
Damn,
you know,
straight we are.
I love that, you know, blogs are still popping 10 years ago. You know, 10 years ago, I joined a small site at Sci-Fi, a tech site, and we were just feeling this land out. You know, I remember going to my first CS and bloggers were like, you know, different from journalists. We had a different press room, you know. they just like thought less of us.
We were like outcasts,
now,
basically.
Yeah.
We were the ragtag team of bloggers who, like, you know, we didn't need a free lunch because we would like go to the garbage can and get people's lunches that they've thrown away because we're,
I mean,
just
we
eating
were
scraps.
Faster and just cooler and just had more interesting takes, and traditional journalists just couldn't handle that. And so, you know, but the business has matured a little bit, and, you know, you've seen some kind of consolidation, and, you know, there are best practices that are combined, which is great. But I think it elevates everyone. And again, we're trying to make Input, you know, into something different, not your typical website. We're not trying to, you know, build The Verge 2.0 or Engadget 2.0. Those already exist and they have their place. And we want to just build something that we like and the audience loves too. You know, it's not just tech, it's tech and tech adjacent stuff. So you'll see style stuff. You'll see more culture stuff. I think we're doing an okay job right now, but we can always do better.
All right. Let's use that to jump right into your iPhone review. Cause there are a couple things I want to say before we get there. First, when you were at Mashable, like, I read all your stuff, it did seem like you were an iPhone guy. Like, that was primarily your beat. You championed you know, Apple products, not because necessarily you were biased, but because you liked them. I think it's great that you kind of were all in on Apple, and you know, that showed in your work. Since moving over to Input, you seem to be open to reviewing everything, and the tone that I get from your stuff is that you're sort of like a technological optimist, that you look for the good in everything, and I really appreciate that. So I want to use that as a framework for reading this review, because, you know, we'll get to your Surface Duo review, your Galaxy Fold review a bit later, but in the context of the new iPhones, right, here's your opening paragraph. My favorite thing about the iPhone 12 and 12 Pro is that is no one feature that outshines any other. Apple may have talked up 5G like it's the second most revolutionary thing ever to happen in the history of phones, but the truth is everything has been upgraded in the iPhone 12 and 12 Pro. Everything. So that's where it starts, and you go through this review. The subtitle is virtually flawless. Now, this is an Android-focused podcast, so I don't want to lose sight of that.
Sure.
But as somebody who's reviewed basically every major Android phone this year, you take, you know, you approach the end of 2020, you take these two devices, and you call them basically flawless. Walk us through that process of how you get there. And if somebody's an Android user, how do you tell them to think about these phones and whether or not they should maybe think about switching if they are sort of on the fence?
Well, first I want to just make a little bit of a correction.
Yeah, yeah, go for it. Go for it. You know, sorry, I didn't want to put words in your mouth.
No, at Mashable, you know, yeah, I did review the iPhones for the last couple of years, but I also reviewed a ton of Android devices. Like, you know, I'm not doing really anything different that at input than I was that I was doing at Mashable. You know, I covered the Note 7 crisis when it, you know, caught on fire, and I thought the Note 7, and I even declared the Note 7 the best smartphone on the planet, period, at that time.
Oh,
and that
same.
Was just, you know, days before they were recalled, you know? So I want to correct that little thing about bias, you know? Like, yes, I do use an iPhone as my main daily driver, but I also really appreciate Android. I in no way am, like, not using Android. And I also carry my own personal Android phone. So, like, yes, I review devices, but the best ones I actually do buy on my own. So I'm a dual device owner. So I got an iPhone and an Android in my pocket because I think that's the only way that a reviewer, a good reviewer, can, you know, understand these products and these platforms, you know, and not be that guy who's just constantly switching because you know what the product that you want, you know, the best one is the one that you actually pay money for. So, you know, the iPhone review, the iPhone 12 and 12 Pro review, I guess, you know, I like to look at the product as a whole, you know. This year, I reviewed a ton of Android phones, starting with, I think, the Galaxy S20 Ultra. Then, you know, you had the OnePlus 8 Pro. You had the Galaxy Z Flip. You had the Galaxy Note 20
so
Ultra.
Many Samsung phones.
I mean, so many names, like the Fold 2. Like, I mean, tons of great phones. The Motorola, I mean, there are just so many devices to choose from. And when you look at those, what they're doing on Android, it's like, it feels like they're a little bit, you know, they're out of ideas, you know, and they're really trying to push the tech bar, and they're pushing it unsuccessfully, in my opinion, which is, I appreciate tech specs. I love tech specs. I'll take a 120 hertz display. I'll take a 100x zoom. But at what point is that unnecessary? Is that overkill and excessive? And I think some, you know, phone makers took that to the extreme this year, you know, and you saw that reflected in the reviews. Yes, it's cool that you have the technology to do 100x zoom or, you know, fold the display, but it comes at the cost of, you know, a crease in the screen. It comes at the cost of, you know, just really blurry images at 100x, you know. So when I say the iPhone 12 and 12 feel like they're virtually flawless, it's because they're not doing anything fancy. You know, they're trying to polish and perfect an existing product. And, you know, after like how many iterations? We're talking about like 13 years of iPhones. You know, it's inevitable that, you know, this device would be as premium and polished as it is, you know?
So from that vantage point, you know, the iPhones, and I want to say that I largely agree with your review based on what I've experienced with the phone as well. Like, these are extremely mature products.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have any notable flaws, right? There's one or two like regressions, maybe in terms of battery life, but overall,
sure.
I think by and large, Apple does a really good job justifying the existence. So let's go through the design, and we'll go into the display a little bit and
sure.
some of the other specs. So from a design perspective, when you first picked this up and you compared it to last year's iPhone, when you compared it to, say, the newest Galaxies like the Galaxy S20 Plus or S20 Ultra or the Note 20 Ultra, what's your impression of the overall design? Like, do you think that this will begin a trend of more squared off angular Android phones, or do you think this will kind of stay in Apple's purview going into next year?
I mean, Apple's design chops, you know, are greatly influential. You know, what they do is kind of a trend that everyone else will tend to copy, especially brands like Samsung or brands like Huawei. But I think that this year with the iPhones, Apple really like kind of differentiates the devices from Android. You know, we were getting so like dangerously close to just the status quo, this generic glass and metal sandwich. You know, every Android phone almost looks identical. You know, they all copied Samsung with the curved edges, the really thin metal frame, and the antenna bands, the placement. Like, it's very hard to tell the difference between one and the other. You know, even the camera bumps, they're all like, you know, they've all moved over to the upper left now. And the iPhones just look aesthetically very different from an Android device. And I don't know if Android makers will necessarily copy them with the squared off edges. But, you know, now you can see that there's a clear difference between these two platforms. And if you care about that kind of thing, then I think it's a good thing. You know, the devices themselves, they feel really good. You know, I mean, if you've ever held an iPhone 5 or an iPhone 4, my first iPhone was an iPhone 4. So I already was, you know, used to this kind of boxy design. But there are tons of like people, younger people who never experienced an iPhone 4, or maybe even iPhone 5, you know?
Oh my God.
This is like,
saying that.
I mean, think about it. I mean, if you're like a 10-year-old, right?
Or yeah.
I mean, you're getting your first iPhone and maybe it's an iPhone 12 or a 12 Pro. I mean, this design is fresh and new to you.
If you're like a teenager and you're getting an iPhone 12 as your first smartphone, like, God bless you, man. Either you're doing well for yourself or your parents have...
I mean, maybe it's not necessarily their first smartphone, but like, if you never experienced an iPhone 4 or 5 or SE, then this design that feels old to like guys like us feels very fresh, very new to them, you know?
Right.
And so, yes, the saying of, you know, everything old is new again, you know, rings very true, I think. And I think that this, you know, when you feel it, when you touch it, you feel the glass, how flush it is with the metal frame, and just kind of the lightness of the 12, at least. It feels like a marked improvement over the 12, over the 11 and 11 Pro, which were kind of like thick boys, you know? Mm-hmm. And that was intentional, right? Apple added a bigger battery, and that was great. But, you know, Apple loves to make their devices thinner every couple of iterations and then make them thicker and add more battery life and market that as a feature, you know?
Yeah, that seems, it seems to be like a red herring of sorts, right? Where they create their own problem and then solve the problem by,
right,
you know, making it thinner again. But at the same time, it did feel like last year they needed to kind of correct the battery issues of the 10S series. I don't know. I feel like, let's stick on the screen for a second here, because I want to talk about this controversy, if you want to call it that, between,
sure,
the iPhone's very good OLED display, the fact that the 12 and 12 Pro now have OLED displays, very bright, very color accurate.
Right.
One could argue that Samsung's displays are still better in some, mm-hmm, ways, but the omission of a 120 hertz option on the iPhones, it was a big deal on Twitter for like 3 days and nobody else knew about it. But that was or could have been a serious marketing advantage for Apple, like what they're doing with 5G, where,
right,
it's undeniable that most people, like, we saw it on our site after the iPhones were announced with 5G, all of our 5G content spiked. Everything that we've ever written about 5G that was, mm-hmm, indexed by Google just spiked in traffic because more people were searching 5G. If Apple had put a 120 hertz display on here the way that they did on the iPad Pro, the same thing would have happened. Apple would have claimed that it was the first and best and whatever, but it would have also been a big deal. The choice for them to omit it seems like maybe a last-minute decision. We know that based on leaks, they were prototyping this technology in their labs. What do you think about that omission compared to something like a Galaxy Note 20 Plus, which has a beautiful display and 120 hertz?
Apple is just, you know, never first, you know, and they don't play that spec game tit for tat with Android device makers. You know, they were not the first company with an OLED display, and yet OLED is, more people know what an OLED versus an LCD is because of the iPhone, right? And more people knew what, like, I don't know, a fingerprint sensor was versus Android. You know, they were not the first to make these innovations, and they don't need to be. That's the scale that Apple commands, you know. 120 hertz means nothing to the average person, you know, because they're using Twitter, they're using Instagram. They don't really see the difference, you know. It's almost like a like nerd tech, right? Like, I think, who was the first one? Like, the first big player was, like, OnePlus to really push this, like, faster, higher refresh rate, right? And they have a very, their audience is very, you know, tech savvy, very nerdy. And same for Samsung, right? Samsung is always about the specs. It's whatever's on the table sheet. And Apple's, I guess, like, MO is just not that, right? 120 hertz will mean something when they can do it, you know? And this year they focused on, like, you know, I don't want to sound like I'm like, it sounds like I'm like, like they're like marketing chief or some bullshit. But, like, you know, they made the devices slimmer, but make no mistake, I'm certain that they will make the devices, the iPhones, like, thicker next year or the year after, then introduce 120 hertz and say, hey, look, this is why we're able to do it, you know?
But I want to push back on that a little bit, if only because, and hey, Otto, I want to bring you into this because you've used all the 120 hertz phones. But the fact that once you use a high refresh rate panel, it's almost like you can't go back. Like, I feel that way, where it's not that the iPhone 12 lacks it and it bothers me when I'm using it, but it's so clear as an advantage when I have two of them side by side, which is a situation most people won't find themselves in, but we find ourselves in that situation.
I think when people buy iPhones, it's not just about the specs, you know? It's about so much more. It's about the software. There are things that you cannot get on Android that are irreplaceable, you know? Like FaceTime, like iMessage, AirDrop. Like, I use AirDrop all the time, like a million times a day. Airdropping stuff from my phone to my iPad to my MacBook. Like, that's part of my workflow. And people can't live without iMessage or FaceTime. Those things are inherently more valuable to a lot of people than, you know, say, 120 hertz display, you know, or even OLED. You know, that's one of the reasons why the iPhone 11 was, I think, the best-selling phone of last year, because, you know, it's got an LCD. It's got not, it doesn't even have, like, a 720p. It had, like, a 720p display, right? And it was a thick boy, thick ass bezels, and yet best selling phone. I mean, that's right there is proof that these kinds of, like, little nerdy specs really don't matter to a lot of people.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, though, like you said, 120 hertz to the vast majority of people is not going to matter, but it is interesting to me that, for me at least, like, the iPad Pro, when Apple first put 120 hertz on that, I think that was the first sort of non-gaming display that I had seen that had, you know, more than a 60 hertz refresh rate. Maybe, like, OnePlus had come out with, like, a 90 hertz display beforehand, but I do think the iPad Pro was the first super high refresh rate display I had seen. So it's, I think it's a bit strange that, you know, Apple just decided not to include it when they were maybe not the first, but at least one of the first to start putting it on a more mainstream device like that, at least in the mobile space.
Well, I saw an interesting video from Dave Tutti, and, you know, he just reviewed the iPad Air 4, and, you know, he was talking about the differences between the iPad Air and the iPad Pro, and, you know, the latency for Apple Pencil, I guess, is, like, a lot less on, or a lot lower on the iPad Pro because 120 hertz versus, you know, 60 hertz on the iPad. So, you know, there's no Apple Pencil support on the iPhone. What is the purpose of adding 120 hertz or a higher refresh rate if it comes at the expense of, say, battery life, you know, or device thickness? And you know how much Apple loves to, like, market how thin their devices are, how smaller, how much smaller they've made it. And like I said, they always go backwards and then move forwards the next gen, right? So it's a formula, it's a pattern, and I have no doubt that a high refresh rate will make it to an iPhone at some point next year, maybe, or the year after. But they're not stupid. They will save some features for the next version, or else, you know, there's not much else they can do, you know, if they're not going to do something as crazy as like a foldable or a swiveling display, or, you know, whatever wacky smartphone is out there, you know.
That's a really good point, because the like Samsung's Note series this year was kind of the same, where the Note 20 launched with a 60 hertz display, the Note 20 Ultra had 120 hertz, and that really was the big difference. I mean, of course, you can see 120 hertz in just everyday use, but it makes the biggest actual difference from a usability standpoint when it comes to the S Pen. So I guess without right. that, there isn't much of a need for it necessarily.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm a tech guy, and I love a 90 hertz, 120 hertz display. But it does seem like a very niche feature right now. Obviously, tech Android people, I think, are a lot more savvy. You know, they're willing to root stuff, they're willing to like get into their device, they're willing to invest in these kind of like first gen technologies, and iPhone people are just not, you know. They'd yeah. rather have their iMessage and emoji or FaceTime or whatever.
I think it's one of those things where Android users are gonna, you know, rub it in the face of new iPhone owners and be like, well, you know, my phone has 120 hertz, why doesn't yours? And they'll be like, okay, that I don't care.
Right. I mean, it should matter. It should matter, yeah. You know, like pick whatever device you want. And, you know, I think Android is always pushing. There are so many Android makers that, you know, there's so much innovation happening. You know, I'm looking at the fast charging, fast wireless charging. Like that stuff is insane right now, right? Like 65 watt. I mean, what are we up to now? Like 80 something now? Like that stuff is beyond what the iPhone is capable of. And here comes the iPhone. It's like, hey, look, faster MagSafe wireless charging, you know, and people are eating it up because they don't really care about like 80 watt fast charging yet, you know?
Well, okay, so I want to talk about that a little bit, because I think it's worth comparing the strategies of a company like OnePlus, which is bundling, you know, a 65 watt charger in the box. It's also a 45 watt power delivery charger just for other phones if those support it, whereas mm-hmm. Apple has taken a completely different approach. It's not bundling an AC adapter in the box at all anymore, but it's pushing this 15-watt wireless MagSafe charging. And it's important to note the reason Apple can do this 15-watt wireless charging on an iPhone is because the MagSafe positions in the same place every time, they can reliably ramp up the wattage of just a regular Qi connection. Whereas on something like the iPhone 11 or other iPhones that are, or even the iPhone 12 on a regular wireless charger, it's maxed out at 7.5 watts because they cannot rely on the fact that you'll get it in the same place every time. So as a result, they don't want to risk overheating of both elements. And they're basically toning it down and they're maxing it out at half the speed of MagSafe on purpose. But Apple has done this really interesting thing where they're complying to some extent with the Qi standard. The MagSafe is a generic wireless charger for any other phone. And yet for the iPhone in particular, it has additional benefits. It has an NFC chip. It has the ability to reliably click into place every time. You know, we talk about the difference between specs and features, right? And how this is a feature that Apple is promoting just for its iPhone products. It's launching this whole accessory ecosystem to go along with it. Some companies, notably, you know, the Belkins and Mophies of the world, have tried this and failed to launch cross-platform accessories like this. But Apple is probably going to be the one that makes it work. What do you think about that strategy compared to a OnePlus or an Oppo, where they're just ramping up the speed without actually providing additional value to the user in terms of features?
I mean, they're vastly different companies with different missions, right? And different ecosystems. Apple's ecosystem is very mature. They have tens of millions, hundreds of millions, billions of devices out there, right?
I think they're up to over a billion, yeah.
Over a billion, right? And, OnePlus is still relatively small compared to them. The one thing OnePlus has is like the advantage of, you know, its parent company, right? It's backed by Oppo, and it has that kind of access to whatever innovations they are working on. And, you know, I think most people just, you know, I appreciate everything OnePlus does. You know, I love that they keep pushing the fast charging further and further. But, you know, it does come at the expense of having to use that specific charger, you know? And is there a notable advantage to that? I mean, that's really up to the consumer. You know, I think it's great, but some people just don't care. You know, some people want that compatibility across all different adapters. And, you know, yes, a MagSafe is just, you know, it will become ubiquitous, I think, you know, especially when Apple inevitably removes the port itself altogether.
Okay, so I want to talk about this, because if you haven't used a MagSafe before, it sounds insanely stupid, right? Here is this wireless charger that actually sticks to your phone, but it's not faster than the wire charger that also, when you plug it in, sticks to your phone. And like you can like hold the phone by the lightning cable and it won't come out. And yet when you start using MagSafe, and I include myself in this because I've been testing it for the last few days, it does feel like the right compromise, where you just stick it on this charger, it snaps into place, it starts charging, it's super easy to remove. You don't really need to worry about like jiggling. Like if you pick up the phone and the MagSafe is attached, you sort of just like squeeze your fingers underneath the phone and the MagSafe pops off.
You just push it off, right?
Right. When you can't really do that with a lightning cable, but it's really difficult to put into words why this is better than using a lightning cable or just a regular wireless charger, other than the obvious reason that you can use this phone while you're charging, right? Like, can you try to explain why MagSafe is better? Because I'm having trouble putting it into words, and I don't want to just sound like a mouthpiece for Apple, right? But there is something tangible about that middle ground of magnets plus wireless charging minus having to plug it in that is actually a better experience. And Hayato, you have the new Peak Design magnet. What's it called? A mobile thing?
Slim Lock is their magnetic system. The case itself, that whole series is called the just Mobile by Peak Design.
Right.
But it's the same general concept, and they got really lucky with the timing, because like Peak Design sent me this case and all of its accessories that come with it right before, well, I guess right after Apple had announced the new iPhones and the MagSafe system. And they got lucky, because basically, I mean, you know, like we've been talking about, their Apple is kind of actually shifting a bit more towards universal standards with, you know, a magnet is a magnet, but things like Qi wireless charging and things like that. Any of, you know, Peak has its own mounting system and its own accessories, but any MagSafe accessories that Apple or authorized retailers make, those will all be compatible with Peak Design's new mounting system. And conversely, Peak's new system will be cross compatible with MagSafe. So you can basically just mix and match between the two, the two sort of accessory ecosystems. And, you know, that way, like if you're an Android user and you get Peak's case or just their mounting adapter, you can use MagSafe accessories on your Android phone. Or if you have an iPhone and you just want to try something that maybe Peak makes that other manufacturers like Apple haven't designed, then you have that option to you as well. I really, really like that we're kind of getting towards this, like we're moving a lot more towards like cross compatibility with accessories in general. And I think that's a really, really great thing.
You know, I think what you just said, Daniel, about like, you know, it's really indescribable why it's better with the MagSafe, even though you're still like you have a wire attached to your device in some way, you know. And I think that's it's hard, right? I think that's why Apple always calls its products like quote unquote magical, you know. Like there's something there that you just can't really describe on paper, you know. It just feels easier. It feels more convenient. Feels futuristic. It feels, maybe the word is, satisfying. Mm-hmm. You know, clicking in a lightning cable or USB cable into your device is like not as satisfying as just like having the magnets click it into place and into the back. You know, you have to like find the thing, align it. Like that like process of it being able to do like half the work is part of the feeling, right? Of what makes this, you know, accessory so awesome. It's almost trickery, to be honest.
But I mean, there's no getting around the fact that like the MagSafe itself, as good of an experience as it is, I think unfairly, it's putting people in an unfair position in the sense that it's $39. It requires a separate 20-watt charger that you may not already own. Right. So that's a $59 investment if you are somebody who's just buying a new iPhone 12 and you need both the AC adapter and the MagSafe. So on that, on paper alone, I would not recommend buying a MagSafe unless you actually know that it's going to make your life better. But the chicken or egg scenario here is that unlike a wireless charger, which is a clearly you set it down and you forget it, right? That whole, I think the best example of that is the Pixel Stand, where it makes your Pixel useful while you're charging your phone, but it's not necessarily a better wireless charger. It's a better stand that happens to charge your phone. Whereas other wireless chargers are pretty passive, and then there's the advantage of you plug in your phone super quickly on something like a OnePlus 8T, you get to 100% in like 35 minutes or 30 minutes or whatever it is, and you can still use your phone because it's plugged in at the same time. So this is a happy medium that is eventually going to be ubiquitous, but right now is a very expensive proposition if you want to buy more than one of them. Plus the fact that it's a pretty big puck, right? It's not small. It's not an Apple Watch size charger. And if you want to travel with it whenever that's possible again, it's going to be another thing you have to carry with you if you have more than one product, because it's not USB-C, or it's it's not like you can't charge everything, right? And I don't know. It feels a bit messy right now, but eventually it'll feel less messy.
It's an extra convenience right now, but like I said earlier, you know, this is clearly Apple laying the foundation for an iPhone without a port at all. You know, a lot of people were very upset that the iPhone 12s didn't come with USB-C. Like, you know, the iPad Pros have USB-C. The iPad Air has USB-C. Why doesn't the iPhone have, you know, USB-C? And I wrote a story about this, and the reason why is very clear that Apple makes a ton of money from selling and licensing out, you know, lightning cables, the spec for that, accessories for that, and they can do the same with MagSafe. You know, they're not going to give that up, you know, and switching to USB-C, like, you know, that's a spec that's they don't own, and they can't really make a lot of money off. And so, you know, whether it's next year or the year after, whenever this portless iPhone comes, you know, we'll have had like a couple of years to get used to this. People will have a couple of years to get used to it. And it won't really feel like an issue. It won't feel like a shock when it happens, you know?
I still think it'll feel like a shock. Like,
I mean, people are still complaining about the headphone jack, and like, I'm like, come on guys, like you got $50 buds out there that sound great. All right. Wireless earbuds that sound great for $50. Like, okay.
You've clearly never talked to Jerry. Like, just saying, our own Jerry Hildenbrand, he would fight you on this. I'm not going to, because as you hear with what's making me happy this week, I'm all in on wireless earbuds. I want to move this conversation, because we've spent a long time on it. Just quickly rounding up the iPhone. I'm not going to talk about 5G because it's a garbage fire most of the place.
Yes, but it is. It's true.
I want to talk about the camera a little bit. So
okay.
I'm having trouble figuring out why somebody should buy a 12 Pro over a 12, right? There's so few differences this year. Mm-hmm. Stainless steel versus aluminum, yes, but the batteries are the same, the screen's the same. It's around, you get the telephoto lens and LiDAR. Mm-hmm. Are right. those two things worth it to add $200 to the price tag for the Pro?
I don't think so for most people.
Yeah.
And that was the same case for last year with 11 and 11 Pro. Yes, this year they're more alike than before, which is fantastic, you know. But for most people, you got to ask yourself, are you going to use that tele lens, that 2x, you know, zoom lens? If you're not, then this is probably not worth it. LiDAR is great for, you know, faster autofocusing in low light. It lets you take night portraits, and it's better for augmented reality. But augmented reality is still kind of like, you know, very early days, and how many people are taking, you know, night portraits. I took a couple and I thought they looked okay. They didn't look fantastic or anything. You know, there's, you can still clearly see it's like, you know, a phone photo. For most people, I think the 12 is actually the better phone, you know, because it's lighter, and it's cheaper, and the cameras are, you know, minus the telephoto and the sensor, the LiDAR sensor, they're just as good. So I think most people are should get the 12. But if you are that pro person like me, I shoot a lot with my iPhone. I went to CES this year, RIP. I went to CES and my whole team, we shot with, you know, iPhones at moment lenses, left our regular cameras in our luggage.
Hey, I don't hear that.
You know, like I'm that guy who buys a 512, and yes, I buy my own iPhones because the ones I have are loaners. I buy the maxed out 512 gigabyte and I fill it up like 2 to 3 times over in a year. Like I take a ton of photos and I take like 4K 60 videos. Like I do not play with like lower resolutions and all that stuff. Like max it out. If you're like me, then that's who the pro is for, you know, like really pushing the phone to its like limits. Like it is like my iPhone 11 Pro is just like, you know, crumbling, you know, like it just can't handle the stuff I throw at it.
You're not ready for this jelly.
Yeah. I mean, the finishes, I mean, also, I guess if you want the finish, you know, I am a caseless guy. I don't use cases on my devices. So yes, my devices get scratched up, but yeah, I think that's fine, you know? And to me, like I can't stand the fingerprints on the glass back on the 12. Mm-hmm. So I'm more of the matte finish guy. You know, the sides I don't care as much, but the back really bothers me, you know. So if you want that, you know, frosted finish, if you want the Pacific blue, you're gonna have to go pro this year.
All right, so we're gonna take a quick break and we're gonna come back and finish this conversation as it relates to the Pixel 5 and 4a 5g. We'll be right back. This episode of the Android Central Podcast is brought to you by Indeed. One of the greatest challenges we face is taking all the information that's available and knowing where to focus. It's the same problem with hiring. With Indeed, you have access to the largest pool of talent and can hire the right people fast. Indeed.com is the number one job site in the world because Indeed gets you the best people fast. Unlike other sites, Indeed gives you full control and payment flexibility over your hiring. You only pay for what you need. You can pause your account at any time, and there are no long-term contracts. Plus, Indeed provides powerful tools to make your search that much easier, like sponsored jobs, which are shown to be 3.5 times more likely to result in a hire. With 73% of online job seekers visiting Indeed each month, Indeed is going to get you the most important hire you need, just like they have for over 3 million businesses. And right now, Indeed is offering our listeners a free $75 credit to boost your job post, which means more quality candidates will see it fast. Try Indeed out with a free $75 credit at Indeed.com/ACP. This is their best offer available anywhere. Go right now to Indeed.com/ACP. Terms and conditions apply. Offer valid through December 31st. All right, so I want to finish this iPhone discussion comparing the photos in your review to the Pixel 5. So there are a bunch of samples. I've linked it in the show notes. You should go read Raymond's review. I keep saying Raymond.
No, Ray, Raymond's
Ray,
fine.
Raymond, whatever you want to be called. There are a lot of really good photos in here and a lot of really good comparisons because I'm jealous of your... This is wonky, but I'm jealous of your CMS because you can show four photos side by side with the labels clearly underneath each photo. Ours can't, and that's something that I've been really jealous of over the last few months as other sites have added that feature. Anyway, you can look at these four photos, the 12 Pro, the 12, the 11 Pro, and the Pixel 5, and determine which one you like better. What's interesting to me is that the daylight photos, I prefer the Pixel 5 better in almost every situation. But night sight or night mode photos, I prefer the iPhone, which I didn't think I would. I just think the iPhone shoots a cleaner photo most of the time. And I'm like shocked that that's the case. And we talked about this last week where the Pixel 5 takes really amazing photos, but the sensor size is now its limiting factor. And
well, even though not just the sensor size, I think the processing speed, right?
Oh yeah, the speed for sure, but that shouldn't matter overall in terms of photo quality if Google is doing the things that it claims to be doing.
Right. You know, the iPhone, I think, has the best camera system. And when I say system, I mean like multiple lenses. I mean, you know, portrait and processing. Like a lot of the stuff that is happening on an iPhone photo is happening in the background. It's all being processed by the neural engine. It's looking at faces. It's looking at the sky. It's segmenting all them. It's processing them differently than compositing them all like in the blink of an eye, so that you don't see like a little spinning wheel. And those are all things that I think are meaningful and add to the experience of shooting with an iPhone versus shooting with a Pixel 5. You know, Pixel phones have tended to gravitate towards like images that are a little cooler, a little more contrasty. And for me, I personally don't love that kind of aesthetic. Because I always end up brightening my images, adding more highlights, and increasing the shadows a little bit. I'm not really into a more dramatic looking photo, and that's what I feel the Pixel cameras shoot with. Those are the types of photos that a Pixel shoots. But, you know, it's really hard to even pick at this point. It's like you're really nitpicking, right? For phones, they're both fantastic cameras. I wish Google had, you know, use the newer sensor. Like I just keep imagining what Google could do with a newer sensor. This is like the same image sensor in the Pixel, what, 2, I believe?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's just so much Google could have done and just doesn't seem to care anymore about doing. And that's a real shame, you know, because just imagine what a Pixel could be like if it had three cameras on the rear. You know?
So Hayato, I want to bring you in here because you just finished reviewing the 4A 5G, which basically takes the same photos as the 5. You also have the 5. You helped me out with my review on that. You've shot tons of video on the 5. The iPhone introduces Dolby Vision HDR output. It shoots crazy good 4K 60. It's just the best video camera you could buy on a phone. When you sort of compare, as Ray said, the systems between the two, which one jumps out at you as being the one that you should point people to if they're just looking for the best camera experience overall?
I mean, if you're looking for the best experience, I think the most versatile is kind of the best option in general. So, you know, the 12 Pro with the telephoto camera in addition to the wide and ultra wide, I think is probably a better bet. I mean, like Ray said, you're kind of just nitpicking at a certain point when you look at these two phones' cameras and try to tell the little differences apart. But I think that's exactly why having an additional camera does help. I really do wish the Pixel 5 would have had a newer sensor. I think Google kind of relies on all of the processing data that it already has, you know, the sort of familiarity with the sensor that it's been using for years. I think that's kind of what enables it to offer the kind of imaging that it does on the Pixel. But this year in particular, it kind of has felt like they're sort of just resting on their laurels and you know, basically just taking the same photos that it has. I do think the Pixel 5 takes much warmer photos than Pixels generally have. And I've always liked a warmer look. That's what I've generally liked about iPhone photos as well. But having more versatility, I mean, like Ray said, like, can you imagine if phones like the Galaxy Note 20 Ultra have these massive main sensors now that have visibly better natural depth of field, all kinds of additional bonuses that I really think the Pixel could have benefited from. I think part of the reason they didn't do that is just because having a larger sensor with, you know, maybe a higher megapixel count would involve more processing, and especially now that there's no more neural core, that processing would be even slower with a higher resolution and more data to work with.
I mean, it doesn't have to be like all resolution. The new iPhones all have 12 megapixel sensors, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's not a jump at all. You know, Apple's been using 12 megapixel sensors for many years.
Yeah. I mean, the larger individual pixels make a bigger difference for sure.
Right. And that's what Google could have done. But, you know, their strategy is just such a mess right now. And that's where the iPhone is just more reliable. It's more consistent. You know what you're getting. And you know that you're going to get a great video camera. And, you know, I've tried every Pixel since the first one. And, you know, I've tried every Nexus before that. And the cameras just don't hold up over time. And it's not just the camera itself. It's like the software limitations, right?
Yeah.
For me, like last year, this was like the most damning of all. I was out, you know, shooting comparisons with the 11 Pro and the Pixel 3. This is before the 4 had just arrived. And it was snapping photos. The Pixel 3 was like 3XL, I believe, was snapping photos, but it just wasn't saving them. Like, yeah. That is just like unacceptable. Every comparison shot I shot was gone. I wasted a whole day because Google Photos crapped out. I had to like reset the entire device in order to like get the camera to work again. And, you know, that's just a bugginess. Like, that's unacceptable. You know, you'd never get that really on iPhone, to be honest.
I mean, look, that was of all the Pixel bugs that have been like just overwhelming the narrative of these phones over the last 5 years, that was the worst, right? Like, there wasn't enough memory. They launched a phone that did not do the job that it set out to do. They fixed that, but it was way too late. The damage had been done. We could do so much on the on all these Pixel bugs. That's actually what my review was about this year, was like, the Pixel 5 is so good because it has no show-stopping bugs. It's not the best phone in any category, but there's nothing that stands out to you as being a super big flaw. This was before the reports of the screen separating from the frame came out earlier this week, but I don't think that's a big enough or widespread enough problem that it's going to haunt the Pixel 5 the way that the memory issues did of the 3, or the fact that the face unlock feature on the Pixel 4 didn't include an eyes open setting at launch. It didn't for like 6 months. The Pixel 2 XL screen was awful. You know, there's just a lot of these issues. Anyway, I want to get back to the Pixel 4a 5G because we were talking about, you know, it's hard to choose between the iPhone 12 and the 12 Pro.
Mm-hmm.
Hayato, you talked a little bit about how the Pixel 4a 5G is priced into a corner because that phone at $500 gives you most of what you get with the Pixel 5, but it's not nearly as competitively priced as the Pixel 4a, and you don't get that much more than the Pixel 4a. So run us through your thoughts around the 4a 5G and where it sits.
Yeah, I mean, it's by and large the same phone as the Pixel 5, right? You have the same 765G processor. You've got most of the same specs. I think there's maybe a 2 gigabyte difference in RAM. It's largely the same phone as the Pixel 5, and I think that's a really good thing in a lot of ways, right? Like, you get the same exact processing power, you get the same experience, exact same software, same cameras. The big differences that you're missing on the Pixel 4a 5G are, of course, things like IP68 water resistance on the Pixel 5. The 4a 5G doesn't have wireless charging in either direction. So it's a lot of small concessions like that that you give up when you go with the 4a 5G. And the 5 is made of metal, even though it doesn't quite feel like it, where the 4a 5G is entirely plastic. Those are the sort of things that I think most people, especially when you're in the market for a 4a, where, you know, the Pixel A series is always sort of aimed at the lower price range, where you already know you're going to be making some compromises. So I think those are the features that people shopping for an A series device are going to be okay with. But I do think if you are looking for the cheaper phone that gives you the core experience really well without charging you extra for features you don't need, I do think the 4A is a better buy. And I've seen a lot of people say that they find the 4A 5G is a better value than the 5, and that's why they would buy that over the 5. But I think, you know, the 5 is sort of for the people that do want those extra features. And if you don't, you really should just get the 4A because 5G in itself isn't worth buying into. Especially on Verizon, where the 4A 5G is an extra $100 to make up for the ultra wideband support.
Boo.
Yeah, like there's no reason to get the 4A 5G when you could spend another dollar a month if you're financing to get the Pixel 5 instead.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to agree with that assessment. I think, Pixel 5 is just too little for too much. I think the 4A 5G, 5G is just not worth it at this point. I mean, if it's not worth it on a $1,000 iPhone, it's not worth it on a $500 device. And I think the 4A is probably the device, the Pixel device. You get a lot of the 4A, 5G, and 5. It's just cost so much less. As long as you're not expecting, the high-end features, its basics, I'd rather use that extra money saved and buy like a pair of wireless earbuds or, something else.
Absolutely. I mean, you're getting the same kind of really great battery life that is kind of unbelievable to be able to save out a Pixel.
Right.
And again, you're getting the same software and cameras and all of that, minus the telephoto or minus the ultra wide, for literally half the price of the Pixel 5. It's an outrageously good deal.
So here's where my argument of like the intangibles come in, right? We're talking about the intangible niceness of something like MagSafe that you can't quite put your words to until you use it. The fact that the iPhone feels better, blah, 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 blah. All the reasons that every Apple user loves their iPhone. That's the way I feel about the Pixel 5. I talked about it on the Vergecast this week, humble brag. You should go listen. It's it was really interesting hearing the divergent takes because I was like rah-rah team Pixel in that conversation. Dieter was like in the middle, and then David Ruddick of Android Police was like, fuck this Pixel, it sucks, basically. And it was really interesting, like the reasons that he brought up for the reason the Pixel underwhelming this year were ones that I don't care about, and the reasons that I love the Pixel are things that he doesn't really take into account. This sort of like ephemeral, intangible experience of using a Pixel is better than using X number of other Android phones. It's the same thing that you get with the iPhone, I think, and the thing that makes the Pixel 5 worth it for me, $699. But I get why some people wouldn't appreciate that. But it's also one of those things that you kind of have to use. You have to have experience with a Pixel before you understand why you love the Pixel experience.
I used to think that, but then I used a OnePlus phone. And, a 7T, I mean, a 7 Pro, I mean, they feel so good. The software is so good. And it's near stock. And I just don't get that same, pure stock joy from, a Pixel anymore. It doesn't feel as special anymore.
I know. I get that. Yeah. I do. I don't know why I still feel that way, but I do. And I'm okay with it because it's one of those things that, but the problem is that I feel like the number of people in that category is dwindling, Ray. Like the number of people who can claim to be like hashtag Team Pixel that are not paid by Google to be part of Team Pixel is dwindling. And that's the reason the Pixel numbers, the sales numbers are not picking up the way that Google wants them to, because OnePlus phones, even Samsung phones are getting closer and closer every year.
Well, and one of the things that it's kind of silly, I guess, but one of the things that I like about the Pixel that I can't get on a OnePlus phone anymore is that the Pixel 5 is basically the perfect size phone to me. And
right.
Phones like the OnePlus 8T, they're enormous, or even the Galaxy S20 FE, which I think is the closest competition to the Pixel 5, and I think it's a better phone in a lot of ways for most people. Even that phone is just, it's enormous holding the two next to each other. It's a really big difference. And that's something that I appreciate about the Pixel 5 more than a lot of its other intangibles. I mean, the haptics are good, maybe not quite as good as on previous Pixels, but the haptics are good. The cameras are obviously great. There's a lot to love about it, but I more than anything just love that I can get a really good phone in a size that fits comfortably in my hand and pocket again.
Right.
Is this like the start of a trend? Like, are we going to see like smaller phones again? Like it.
Yeah.
I mean, the iPhone 12 mini, right?
Small as in like that size, like almost like 5.5 to like 6 inches.
It's the size of most people's hands. Like I don't, that's okay. So again, I don't want to belabor the iPhone conversation because anybody who listens to this show to hear us talk about Android is probably already tuned out. But I do want to bring up the fact that the iPhone 12 Pro Max is going to have that massive sensor that's 50% larger than the one in the iPhone 12 series. And I'm just like, why did you not do that for the regular iPhone 12? I know it's space constraints related, but also like, right. It pains me that I'm going to have to use a large phone to get the best camera out of the iPhone. Like, I don't want to use a Pro Max. That phone is huge. And
same.
It just is. It's so frustrating. The fact that like...
Well, we'll have to see like how much better the images are, you know, if there's a meaningful upgrade there. Like, you know, when the 7 and the 7 Plus came out, I bought a 7. I didn't really care about portrait mode at that time, you know, but now it's like, you know, how much better is that sensor? Are you going to get truly better low light photography? And are you going to even use it? That's the thing, you know, if you're not going to use it, then it's kind of pointless, you know?
I mean, to me, the most exciting phone in Apple's lineup is going to be the iPhone 12 mini, just because I want to see how much of that camera experience and the battery life and all of that, like how much of that is retained in, you know, this tiny form factor that's even smaller than the Pixel 5. Like, how much can we keep in a small body?
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I think Apple's already proved that they can miniaturize their flagship, you know, technology. You know, you look at a phone like the new iPhone SE.
Look at the
worst thing
Apple
about
Watch.
That device. Right. The worst thing about, like, the new iPhone SE is battery life, right?
Yeah.
The camera itself is as good as the 11, and the processing is as fast as the 11. So the really only question I have for the mini is going to be, is the battery life going to be enough, you know?
Yeah.
I'm concerned given the regression in battery life on the 12 Pro that I've been experiencing. It's not terrible, but it's noticeable. So I'm a little worried about that. But yeah, I mean, Apple's not claiming massive battery reductions with the 12 mini. It's, what is it saying? So 15 hours of video playback, 10 hours of whatever that means. Like, it's so pointless to even say it that way.
I mean, they have a like benchmark that it's like an iPad, right? An iPad has like the benchmark is 10 hours battery life. Mm-hmm. Could they have gotten to 20 hours by now? You know, it's been 10 years. Absolutely, they could have.
Yeah.
But the benchmark is always 10 hours. And so they have a definite like a bar for battery life in terms for the iPhone. And as long as it's not under that bar, I think it's they really don't care. You know, they find it acceptable.
Yeah.
All right. So we have gone long on this iPhone conversation. So we're not going to talk about the Amazon Echoes. We'll bring on either Joe or Jeremy next week because they actually reviewed them. Basically, the new Amazon Echo, it's great. It sounds better. The Amazon Echo Dot and Echo Dot with the clock, they sound better. If you want a new Echo, you should go buy them. Whatever. We'll talk about them next week. I do want to talk a little bit before we get to the Foldy phones, Ray. I want to talk about your report on the OnePlus removing Facebook's bloatware from their new phones. You broke the story. You were really, I think, instrumental in getting them to change this, if just because you were really outspoken about it on Twitter, on the website. Walk us through what happened. This was back in August when you discovered this, and only now did they commit to removing this bloatware. But just walk us through the process, if you wouldn't mind.
Well, first, I want to shout out Android Police because they were the ones who really surfaced it first. But I think it was really my editorial that really, like, you know, exploded.
Yeah, you amplified it like crazy.
Right. And, you know, I've reviewed every single OnePlus phone for the last couple of years, you know, and watch them grow from this like little startup, this massive I wouldn't say they're massive, but like to a formidable player in the Android space. Right. And, you know, for me, seeing the company evolve and grow, like, you know, you see the ups and downs and you see the good and the bad. And I want to see what that OnePlus is still, you know, still believes in its core values, you know, and still, servicing the users first, you know, versus profits. And so that really just like annoyed me that OnePlus, a brand that, you know, projected itself as, you know, not being Samsung, not being like other Android players, not installing bloatware, is suddenly doing the same exact stuff that it fought against, you know? And that is what kind of really annoyed me. And that is what pushed me to write this editorial. And I didn't expect to, like, you know, hit Reddit and, like, you know, blow up and, like, you know, even like reach the higher ups, whoever that is. You know, OnePlus told me that people at the top saw it and they were just like, you know what, we're right, we shouldn't be doing this. And I'm sure I cost them millions of dollars, you know. I don't know what the monetary exchange for the Facebook deal, but the fact that it's Facebook, I mean, they have tons of money to throw at a company like OnePlus for a partnership, right? But I am glad that the users have you know, kind of won, you know, and that OnePlus is doing right by the customer, because I think it's important that they don't lose sight of that, or else they'll just end up being Samsung, you know?
Totally.
So yeah, when I wrote that story, I was like really fired up. I usually don't tend to write like these like really, you know, opinionate pieces on Android, because, you know, there are tons of websites like Android Central and, you know, Android Police that already kind of do this. But this really hit home for me because I've always been a strong supporter of OnePlus, you know, and to me, it just felt like a complete betrayal of all of their principles. And I just had to do it, you know, like whether that would have cost me, like, you know, access to reviewing OnePlus phones, I just didn't care because I felt like this was the right thing to do.
I really enjoyed it because, like, last week, I think we talked about how OnePlus was sort of falling back on its original mantra in general of, you know, they always tried to be this sort of more affordable alternative to companies like Samsung. And, you know, these days they're basically at the same price point. And it kind of felt like they were no longer the company that they used to be. So seeing them sort of stick with this whole for the consumer mindset with this move, like you don't really see that happen a lot with other companies where they just completely walk back on a what's clearly a big business decision.
Right.
Just for the consumers. I think that's really, really great to see. Is still like a thing that can happen at OnePlus.
Yeah.
I mean, it's great that they don't have, like, they're no longer installing Facebook apps and Facebook services on the devices. The one downside is that there's no way to remove Facebook services from phones that already have them.
Yeah.
Like, you can disable them, and you could have always, like, you know, removed and uninstalled the Facebook apps like Messenger, Instagram, but there's no clear way to remove these services. Now, there are workarounds. Like, you can go into your phone and, like, you know, find a hack and, like, you know, delete stuff. But for the average consumer who may not be, you know, comfortable with that, that kind of sucks, you know? But also, OnePlus people are, owners are pretty savvy. So if they want to really remove that stuff, I'm sure they'll find a way. And there's still Netflix. They still pre-install Netflix. But I find that less egregious than, you know, Facebook, you know, because I think a lot of people have opinions about Facebook, whereas Netflix, it's like, okay, the reason they're installing Netflix is to get better optimization for HDR. And to me, that's fine.
Which,
you know,
is
as
BS
long as it's
because
not...
you don't need to, all Netflix needs to do is whitelist a phone to get access yeah. to its Whitevine DRM. Like, that is not a thing you need to do you don't need to pre-install it to get that access. It just makes it easier for the companies to negotiate that access. But yeah.
Right.
But it's still like far less of a privacy and security concern
exactly.
than something like Facebook.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think it was the right move. I wonder how, if any, it had to do with the internal machinations of Carl Pei leaving, Pete Lau taking more of a sort of more control of the company internally and dictating its the future of its vision, right? We know that they're going to announce new Nord phones for the US and Europe that are going to be cheaper than the OnePlus Nord.
I have a lot of thoughts about these devices.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Like, we're expecting, there was a rumor that it was going to be announced on Monday. So this is, we're recording this Friday the 23rd, Monday the 26th, it's supposed to be announced. But, you know, no real confirmation about that one way or the other. Android Central has actually released specs for the N10 and N100. You know, we know a lot about it. We have the first leaked renders of the N10. Looks exactly the same as the 8T, which is really interesting. So yeah, all of these things kind of reinforce the fact that OnePlus is moving in a different direction. They're trying to bring Nord to the US, which doesn't make a ton of sense in my opinion. But I don't know. I mean, the OnePlus 8T is just a confusing product in general. So
I think 8T is a good product. You know, I've been using it, and I think it's a good device for the price. I am very concerned about how much OnePlus is trying to bite off. You know, you've got the flagships, you've got this like middle tier, and then you've also got these budget Nords. And, you know, I think the Nords are worrying. You know, I think the first Nord was great, is great. You know, it's not available in the US, but you get so much for that device. And that's why I said it was a better device than the Pixel 4a. You just get so much more for your money. But these new Nords are like very worrying. Like, you know, especially with the specs, if the leak specs are true, man, I think that OnePlus is like going in the wrong direction. You know, they're trying to cater to everybody. And yes, I understand that. That's where you get growth. That's how you become bigger. But at the same time, what are the values of the company, right? And I'm very curious to know the kind of move away from those values is maybe one of the reasons why Carl Pei left, you know? Because I know Carl. I've talked to him. I've interviewed him many times. I interviewed him right before the Nord launched. And he's very adamant about servicing the user, putting them first, and not compromising as much as possible. And that's why you got a device like the Nord. He led the project for the Nord. And I think that phone spoke for itself, you know? It wasn't the best, but like still very accessible. And these new devices, I mean, if the specs are true, they're not going to cut it, man.
It will be interesting, especially once we find out US pricing. That'll be key to figure out whether it's a good competitor to something like the Pixel 4a or the iPhone SE, or whether it just kind of, it just dies on the vine. So dies on the wide vine, if you will. Dad joke. Okay. So we're going to take another break vine. And don't even say anything, Hayato. Okay, just don't. we're going to take another break and we'll come back and talk about the LG Wing, the Surface Duo, and the Galaxy Z Fold 2. Be right back. This episode of the Android Central Podcast is brought to you by Roman. Talking about erectile dysfunction is not easy. Usually, we just brush it off or blame ourselves, saying things like, I lost my mojo, or avoid it altogether with excuses like, I had a long day at work, or sorry, honey, I'm just not feeling it. But with Roman, it is easy to talk about. With a healthcare professional who can prescribe real medication, it's simple, safe, and totally discreet. With Roman, you can get a free online evaluation and ongoing care for erectile dysfunction, all from the comfort and privacy of your home. The healthcare professional will help you to find the best treatment plan. If medication is appropriate, Roman will ship it to you with free 2-day shipping. The whole process is straightforward, simple, and discreet. And getting started is simple. Just go to getroman.com/ACP and complete an online visit. Erectile dysfunction used to be tough to tackle, but now there's Roman. Complete an online visit today to connect with a healthcare professional and take care of it. Go to getroman.com/ACP, and if approved, you'll get up to $50 off your first month of ED treatment. That's GetRoman, GetRoman.com/ACP. All right, so we're going to end the show, Ray, talking about all these foldy phones that you've used this year. Do you have the LG Wing? You wrote about it.
I do.
Okay. Yeah, because you have all the phones. I'm sure you don't have time to write about everything. If you're like me, you just use them. But you wrote extensively about the Surface Duo. You got an exclusive interview with Panos Panay earlier this year when it came out. You've used the Galaxy Z Fold. Your pinned tweet has like a million likes because it's a video of you removing the screw protector on the Surface.
Z Fold 2. Me in a lot of trouble.
Well, we have a story about that as well if Hayato wants to share it. And overall, you've just had a lot of fun with these foldy phones this year. So walk us through how you see it. You know, you've just reviewed the iPhone 12 and 12 Pro, the most mature phones ever released, blah, blah, blah. And then there's this other category entirely.
I see it as, like, you know, just a lot of fun, to be honest, you know, and the fact that Android makers need to try these bold things. When you have a device like the iPhone that is so mature, everyone knows that you're going to, iPhone users are going to upgrade, right? But what is the incentive to upgrade to a new Note? You know, I reviewed the Note 20 Ultra this year, and I'm like, this is great, you know, this is fine, but, like, what's next, you know? And I didn't really feel like that phone pushed things to the next level to a point where it's like there's a compelling reason to upgrade if you already had a previous Samsung phone or Android device, you know? There's nothing that locks you into that system, you know? Whereas an iPhone has, like, you know, all the features I mentioned earlier, iMessage, FaceTime, all that good stuff, right? Apple-y exclusive stuff. What is the exclusive thing that would keep you on an Android phone or on a Note? I don't really feel there is any real advantage if you already have a previous Note device. So, you know, I like seeing these companies try new things. I love seeing the weirdness. Yes, they're like kind of not ready yet. They're half baked, but we're getting better. You know, I think this year Samsung really proved that it can get better with the second gen. You know, the Galaxy Z Flip, I think that was, like, informed by, you know, improvements that they were working on for the Galaxy Z Fold 2. Z Fold 2 is, like, still a big boy, still a thick device, but it's just so much better than last year. Like, there are fewer question marks on it. There are fewer reliability issues. And, you know, you got devices like the Wing. You know, LG's in the toilet right now. They have no choice but to try something weird and different. And Microsoft just returned to mobile, and they also have no choice but to be, like, strange and odd and, you know, present you with this Duo device that's, like, more for productivity and not for, like, you know, photography. So I think everyone's approach is a little bit different, and I like seeing that diversity. And, you know, choice is ultimately great, and this is all still first-gen stuff, you know? So it is exciting that phones are, like, not so boring again, you know? They are very expensive for all these, like, you know, foldable, bendable, whatever devices, but at least they're not boring.
I think the value prop of something like the Z Fold 2, even at $2,000, is pretty clear. The Surface Duo, which happens to be on sale for $1,200 today at Microsoft.com, if you're listening to this and you're interested, it's $200 off, so maybe go check it out. But even at $1,200, it seems like an odd product. And I've used it. I went through the growing pains as you did, I'm sure. What's your take on it a month and a half, 2 months after its release, when all the hype has died down? Do you still pick it up and go, holy crap, this is the future?
It's great that you asked that, because I literally have been using it this week. You know, I had it, like, uncharged, and I decided to, like, pick it up again this week. And, you know, there was a software update that got pushed out, and that actually ironed a lot of the bugs that a lot of people saw on day one. You know, there was a day one launch software update as well. But I think the initial, like, bugginess is, like, not much of an issue anymore. It's not as bad as it was. So things are a lot smoother. Gestures just work better. They're more responsive. Yes, the camera's still, you know, absolutely crap, but, you know, you don't buy that device for shooting photos. In terms of, like, you know, reading stuff, you know, I think it's an enjoyable device. It's a different device. I like that it folds, but it still does have its issues. You know, like, yesterday I plugged it in at 100%, unplugged it, it was closed, I didn't touch it for a couple hours, and it was already down to, like, 80%. It was, like, draining on standby like crazy. But I think it is a fascinating device. You know, Microsoft is very, like, when I spoke to Panos, he was very, like, clear in the fact that this is not going to replace your regular phone. This is most likely going to be a secondary phone for a lot of people, or people who just really love Microsoft, you know, real fanboys.
Yeah, we know a few of those people.
And, you know, the response, I think, to the device was actually a lot better than I expected, you know? I think there was a lot of enthusiasm for that kind of form factor, and still first gen, but I still find it a fascinating device. I know a lot of people didn't like it because they were like, oh, it's too buggy and whatnot. But you really have to, like you just said, you really have to use it for, like, you know, a couple of weeks a month or a couple of months after for you to really adjust yourself to it. And, you know, it's such a weird device because you really have to adjust to it. You know, you have to like change your behaviors and the way you use a phone. If you're expecting just like your typical slab experience, then you're not going to get a lot out of it. If you are willing to change your behaviors, your habits, and your notions of what a phone is, you know, flip it around, bend it, use two apps at once, then I think it's a very interesting and compelling device. Because I personally do use two apps a lot. You know, I love using Feedly and I love using Twitter at the same time. And to me, that is, you know, there's value there. And like yesterday, I was watching debates, trying to read the news and check out what's happening on Twitter while watching the debate on my TV. And I just wouldn't have been able to do that on my iPhone. You know, I just didn't want to take out my laptop to do that either, you know?
Yeah.
So I think there is value there.
I think your point about adjusting sort of your expectations when it comes to using it as like not wanting to use it as a normal phone is a really good point to keep in mind, just because something like when I reviewed the Galaxy Z Fold 2, it's such a different device, obviously, from a normal smartphone, but you still kind of can use it like folded as sort of this more typical phone, where the Surface Duo doesn't really give you quite the same level of familiarity, but it, because of that, it allows you to do very different things that like my Pixel definitely can't do half the things you can do on a Duo, or maybe even on a Z Fold 2, just because of the different form factor.
Right. That's why I'm a little more optimistic with like foldables than I was last year. Last year I was all about like, you know, this will never work.
Yeah.
But I see the technology is getting better. I see Samsung is making some real like leeway in terms of like improvements of like reliability, durability, and they're really trying. It's not like this is like a half step. This Z Fold 2 felt like a major leap over the first one.
Yeah.
You know, in every way,
huge improvement.
And you know, there are some things that could get better, like the thickness and the weight and all that stuff. But if they can solve some of those issues or those problems, then some compromises like the crease probably wouldn't matter as much, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, eventually those will all get solved, but it does feel like now that we're into the second, going into the third year of this, they have no choice. They have to fix these problems if they ever want the form factors to be anything but a niche enthusiast category. And eventually, I'm sure Microsoft and especially Samsung wants foldable phones to be mainstream, for sure. They will have to, unlike LG, which is leaning into the Wing as an experiment. And
right,
we know exactly what's going to happen with that. But and the answer is that it's not going to be successful. But you know, at least they're trying. So welcome.
Well, I think right now we're kind of in this like Gen 1.5 of foldables, right? Because
yeah,
Samsung is clearly on Gen 2 with the Z Fold 2, but everybody else is sort of putting out their first foldable device this year. And I think next year, as we kind of get into more of what I guess I would call a Gen 2 of the foldable concept in general, I think that's when we're hopefully going to start to see a lot more, you know, refined and mature designs that people should actually buy, right? Like I think right now the Fold 2 is maybe the only foldable that I would really recommend somebody go out and buy if they've got the cash to burn. I don't think you should buy it because it's $2,000, but if you just have disposable income like that, then I think it's easy to recommend as like the only solid foldable. And I would love to see that sort of change and have a lot more diversity of maybe like you don't like Samsung or you don't like that form factor. You can, you know, maybe you should buy a Duo 2 or even a Wing 2 if you consider that a foldable.
See, I think the wrong way to look at it is that these types of new form factors have to replace existing form factors.
Right.
The slabs that we have right now, they're not going away for a very long time, just as traditional clamshell laptops didn't go away. You know, even though we got 2-in-1s, we got 360 devices, we got, you know, Surface Pro devices that, you know, convert into laptops or detach into tablets. Like, one does not need to kill the other to be successful. And I think, you know, foldables and these weird form factors will always, they can find success as a premium niche product because there are people willing to pay for, you know, different, you know. So you know, when I first assessed foldables as like, oh man, these will never replace like regular slabs, I think my approach was just wrong. You know, I thinking that and expecting that is unrealistic. You know, these are clearly not mainstream products and they may never be, you know, and I think I'm okay with that, to be honest. You know, it's nice to also have options and varieties, you know, diversity in the mobile space, because, you know, for the last couple of years, we've only had like these like glass and metal sandwiches. And, you know, that's why we've been so bored. I personally have gotten so bored, you know, with phones. And it's nice that there's something new out there, something different, even if it's not necessarily perfect or, you know, maybe it's even a fad, you know?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, do you find that you've had to sort of adjust your own approach to reviews when it comes to foldables in wanting to, I guess, not wanting to come across as just bored with slabs? Because I found that in my Fold 2 review, like, a lot of people were like, this guy's clearly just, you know, tired of regular smartphones, and that's why he's excited about this shitty phone. And I'm like, no, it's a really good phone regardless. And you're right. Like, you don't have to view it as a replacement for normal phones. It's just like, it's hard to not sound bored when you're of normal phones when you're so excited by the foldables. I think
I definitely have had to adjust my thinking a little bit. You know, the context matters, you know, and the foldables are just much better this time around, so it's, I have to give it a more of a fair shake, you know.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm personally still bored with regular slabs, but I think the ideas are interesting, and we should be grading them on the potential as well. You know, I know a lot of people's like, oh, you should never buy a phone for what it promises for tomorrow, but this is kind of like it's almost like a innovation edition. You know, this is like not the mainstream right now. It's like a TV. You know, an 8K TV is like the potential, but a 4K TV is what we have now, right? And
yeah,
an iPhone is what we have now, or a Pixel is what we have now, but a foldable is what's possible. And we should always be optimistic about what's happening, what's could be possible, even if it ends up not being the case, you know?
Right.
Because, I mean, that's what tech is, you know? That's what makes it interesting.
Yeah, I mean, we could get into this whole debate about whether there's enough content, whether there's enough use cases to justify the existence. Some people would say yes, others would say no. I don't think we can go there today because we're already running a bit long, but maybe we'll have you back the next time one of these companies, Samsung, Microsoft, LG, releases a weird phone, and we'll discuss it more fully.
Yeah, I'd love to be back.
All right, so let's go into our last segment. This is our segment every week that we talk about something that's making us happy. We like to end the show on a high note. We like to end the show with some positivity, especially right now when everything seems so gloomy. We'll start with Hayato because you've done this before and I like yours. I appreciate yours. So what is making you happy this week?
Right now, I'm just happy that we're sort of nearing the end of Techtober.
Yes.
Right? Like some sort of inside baseball, I guess, for people that aren't familiar with the industry. But like September, October, it is by far the busiest time of year for tech journalists, tech reviewers, whatever you want to call us. This is kind of when everybody is putting out new devices. And obviously, we've been talking about so many different phones just because these have all come out very recently in the last couple of weeks. And especially when you're like a smaller team, there's only so much you can do to delegate, you know, 25 phones to 10 people or whatever. So we're kind of near the end of it. It's been an exhausting couple of weeks, but you know, we're getting close to the end. And then by mid-November or December, we'll be complaining about how bored we are that there's nothing to talk about.
Yeah, I know how funny that is. Yeah, you've also been really busy because you've been on both sides of the production pipeline. You do written reviews, you do video, you do all the photos for some of the reviews. Like, you do it all. So I really do appreciate how much work you've done this month. And maybe once November hits, you can sleep a little bit.
Maybe.
Maybe I'll let you sleep. We'll see. I'm sure I'll find other things for you to do.
Please let him sleep.
All right, Ray, what is making you happy this week?
Riding my electric scooter. So I bought a used Boosted Rev. I know Boosted is like a dead company right now, but like,
R.I.P.
You know, I had reviewed their electric scooter last year. I thought it was great. And when I saw it, you know, discounted on Craigslist, I decided to pull the trigger. I bought it in like spring. April-ish, I think. And it's just been a good way to like get out of the house. You know, I work from home now. I really miss going to office. I miss seeing my coworkers. I'm so sick of Zoom and I'm so sick of like Slack because it's constantly, you know, gets rowdy. And just being able to ride freely for like, you know, 30 to 40 minutes every day after work, it's just been so relaxing. You know, and I'm not trapped. I don't feel trapped. You know, I feel like it's just a nice way to decompress and escape from the online world, you know, the terrible online world.
Yeah. I'm jealous that you'll be able to do that mostly throughout the winter because you can do that in New York. It doesn't snow that much. Whereas here it's not possible. You can't, once it starts getting super cold and rainy or snowy, you can't use your bike. You can't run outside anymore unless you're crazy and use spikes on the bottom of your shoes. So whenever Sam Sheffer would like post a video on YouTube with him riding a boosted board in the middle of winter, I was like, dude, come on. Like, this is so unfair.
It's no Toronto, but I mean, have you been to New York in like February? Because
I'm not saying it's kind of warm, Hayato, but it is not Toronto. That's very, very, I want to make that distinction very clearly.
I probably won't be riding when the weather gets bad, but you know, for now, I'm boosting out of my neighborhood, man.
I mean, let's just say I can't even bike outside most days now in mid to late October because it's cold. Mm. So, yeah, it's a different climate here altogether. But I do have a dog, so I need to take her out. Like, she's getting older, so I'm taking her out like 4 or 5 times a day. So what's making me happy this week? I just got my Jabra Elite 85T wireless earbuds in for review. These are like I've been boosting, I guess, the Jabra Elite brand for years. I love them. I think that they're the best true wireless earbuds you can buy. If you were using an Android phone, like AirPods, I guess, are better for iPhone users because they're integrated. But like Jabra Elite 75T are insanely good. They sound great. The 85T are a little bigger because they have a wireless charging case and they have ANC, active noise canceling. So far, I've had them about 24 hours. They're so good. I'm so excited to compare them to the Sony WF-1000 XM3, the AirPods Pro, the Sennheiser True Wireless Momentum 2, whatever they're called.
Damn, these names.
But yeah, they're so good so far. I'm super excited to review them. So yeah, that's what's making me happy this week. They're just great. I like headphones. If I could write about headphones all week, or all day, every day, I would. It would be my dream.
Who says you can't?
Me. I
was gonna say you run the site. It's all your call.
Yeah, I do. But that's the thing. I know that nobody would read them if I just wrote about these like 40. We write about headphones enough.
I would.
Trust me. I assign more headphone content than I think my boss would like, but. That's my little rebellion. So I get away with it. Anyway, that's the show. Ray, if people want to find out where you are on the internet, where can they do that?
You can follow me on Twitter at Ray Wongy. That's RayWongy.
Amazing. Thanks so much for being here. It's been really fun talking to you.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun.
And Hayato, I'll let you plug whatever you want to plug, your song covers if you want.
Yeah, I mean, if you want just my music and things like that, then Instagram's cool. Otherwise, Twitter is where I post more of my tech stuff. It's all just my name, Hayato Huseman, HayatoHuseman.
All right. And yeah, go visit inputmag.com and read all of Ray's awesome work there too. My name is Daniel Bader. You can find me at Journey Dan. You can find all of our work at androidcentral.com. And if you have any feedback for me, for us, for the show, hit us up at podcast@androidcentral.com. We love hearing from you. That is it. We will be back next week with another show. Until then, have a safe and happy 7 days. So long.
See you next time.